Is the Old Testament law something to be afraid of, especially if you are a woman? Is it a problem to be overcome on the way to a more positive, uplifting, and serviceable vision of the Bible's relationship to the messy realities of human life? What use could there be in the Old Testament generally for our pursuit of communion with God? Deep beneath our wrestling with the Old Testament on gender is a difficulty with the Old Testament itself. In our last lecture, which is more meditation than academic argument, Dr. Josberger exalts Torah in the pursuit of God and his blessed fellowship. Thank you again for your support of Greystone Theological Institute and the Lydia Center for Women and Families. And now our last lecture, Lecture 5 by Dr. Rebecca Josberger, Loving God, Loving Torah, the Father in Israel as Agent of Righteousness and its Tragic Distortions.
Right. For this afternoon's lecture, I want to do something a little bit differently than we've done so far in the series. So far in the series, we've had very polished readings of academic papers. I've been incredibly impressed and encouraged by the work of Dr. Hobbs and Dr. Garcia. I want to refer back to those a little bit. I'm sort of revamping the title of my talk because it fits the contents of what I was going to say as a response, if you will, not an academic response, but a furthering kind of response of the talk that Mark just gave. If you didn't hear it yet online, please, please go back and listen to it. Fabulous. So if I remember correctly, the title of his talk was something along the lines of, Are Women Safe in the Church? And he dealt with a passage in John with the woman at the well. Well, my impromptu, as I was sitting there listening, title change is, Should Women Be Safe in the Church? Now, women isn't really my primary concern as someone who looks at the text and is handling issues of Torah and of authority. I think in terms of the ones without as much authority or the voiceless ones. But for the sake of how this weekend seems to be evolving, I think it's perfectly appropriate to put the role of, or put women in that particular role. So you'll see, hopefully by the end of the conversation, how that exactly fits. When I say, should women be safe in the church, I would hope that the obvious answer would be yes. But I think experientially, that sometimes isn't the case. And so as we're talking, you're going to see that I'm going to be unpacking what does it mean then to be safe, and on what grounds should we make sure that women are safe. Now, there's a couple disclaimers. I always have to give disclaimers before I speak. It's my personality, just because. Just to kind of set you up. The first thing I want to say is that I come to this topic in two roles. I come as a person in a position of authority. An authority that's given to me by virtue of my education, my recognition in the field, in the broader church, if you will. I have a PhD. I'm not trying to boast. I'm just telling you that when students come to my office and see Dr. Josberger on the door, I have authority over them, not just in the grade book, but authority they give me, whether I walk into it or not. And that's one of the things I've had to learn even in my role. I walked very quietly. My dean called me in the first year and said, you need to learn some swagger, girl. All right, I'll walk with more confidence and a little less deference. But I have that authority. So I am speaking as a person who does hold authority. I hold a voice, and my audience typically is to others who also have that authority. Now, the other side of my role is that I am speaking, and this is just the reality of my academic situation, as one who is only, well, only has a voice because I have been given it by men. I'm not complaining about that. That's a whole different topic, and that is not one that I personally would complain about, because for me, that would be self-promotion, and I don't agree with that, the self-promotion part. So there's a sense of awkwardness even as I come to this topic. It's more comfortable to me to speak from it to it from the position of authority than the gender role. Does that communicate? That makes sense. So I'm bringing both. And the way I want to approach it, and I hope this comes across, is that my gender is part of who I am, and it allows me to see a sensitivity that maybe wouldn't be seen. It has definitely given me experiences in life that I might not have faced were I not the voiceless one, the more vulnerable one. But that will be, I hope, the only part of that role that informs this discussion. Otherwise, I'm speaking from the role of one who has authority, who has read the text, studied the text, knows how to handle the text. The second disclaimer, if you will, it's not really a disclaimer, the second whatever it is to pave the way for the rest of the talk that I want to give, is that, well, I would really like to go through and just elucidate the scriptures and tell you why Torah suggests, and I'll tell you right away from the beginning, the answer to should women be safe in the church, and on what grounds? Yes, because Christ / God, they're one and the same. I know we know that, but I think sometimes Old Testament, New Testament dichotomy, we forget that. Acts on behalf of the vulnerable, and if we want to reflect him, we will too. So that's the answer up front, and I would love to just dive in and expound it, but I find that often people aren't quite ready for that. I don't mean that as... this is a side note. One time I was praying for my Hebrew students before a test, and I asked that the Lord help their little brains. So I do not mean it as a derogatory. I mean it as we, the church in general, the people of God, have not always handled the Old Testament with the level of reverence that and value, just plain value, that I think it requires. So before I get into all the other things, I'm going to try to jump on my favorite soapbox, my favorite topic, and talk to you about the place of Old Testament law, of Torah. Now, to do that, I'm going to talk to you about my journey, my journey with Torah. Because it's the only way I know how to explain and walk someone through where I came from and where I ended up. Where I started was, I love the scriptures, I am a PhD student, I focus on the Pentateuch more than any other, it's my favorite, partly because I like stories. Stories convey to me. Paul is a little lofty for me. I don't always understand him, but stories, I'm good with those. So I love the Pentateuch. If you know the Pentateuch well, you know that it's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. I love all of the Old Testament, but I particularly am passionate about the Pentateuch. As I was studying these, now remember, I was a PhD student committing my life to study those books. So if anyone was going to value the instructional pieces, the biblical law portions, it would be me. But I sort of tolerated them, but didn't understand them, and it really didn't bother me. Now, one thing you need to know about my personality, although I probably don't need to tell you, it will become apparent. I get passionate about things, and in my passion, I can be a little, I'm going to be pejorative, dogmatic. I hope it isn't dogmatism, but I can be a little hyperbolic. I can overspeak, so some of the things may need correction. But I think sometimes it's attention-getting, and it causes us to face the truth. And the truth that I'm asking you each to face is that in the church in general, and quite possibly in each one of you in particular, that's not me to judge, it was in me, is the idea that, and I'm going to put this hyperbolically, if I were to go to a deserted island, and I could take all of the scriptures with me except one part, because it's a hypothetical game we play, right? I have to leave one book behind. what book would it be? I think my answer would have been the book of the law, Deuteronomy, because Jesus fulfilled it, and I have it in the New Testament, so that's the piece I don't really need. And I don't know what to do with it anyway. It's really removed from me, and it doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Anyone sort of relate to that, if you're gut, raw, honest? I know it's hard to be that honest, but I think that's how we handle the church. The church handles the text. So I was in class one day with Dr. Block, who, by the way, if I say anything intelligent, it is thanks to his training and ideas. If I say anything idiotic, it's mine, and he loves me anyway. It'll be okay. All right. I was in a class on Deuteronomy as a student, as a TA, as a mentor to other students. And Dr. Block did some things that I'm going to adopt here to do for you because they were so impactful. The first thing he did was read excerpts from Psalm 119. Now, I'm not going to read the whole psalm to you. If you are very well versed in the psalms, you'll know that's a really good thing because it's quite lengthy. And in fact, I'm not even going to read straight portions of it. I'm going to read verses that I have marked myself in order to emphasize my point. So it's not even all the way through. It's very clearly crafted so that you can hear what I heard when I sat there and he read this. So Psalm 119. Blessed are they whose ways are blameless, who walk according to the law of the Lord. Blessed are they who keep his statutes and seek him with all their heart. They do nothing wrong, they walk in his ways. Now, as a person sitting there hearing this, I was excited. Yeah, blessed are they, of course. Yeah, yeah. The focus was on, what do I get out of this? Now, when I got to verse 3, they do nothing wrong. Oh, shoot, maybe I shouldn't be so excited because this might not apply to me. But I'm going to hang in there with it. You, speaking to the Lord, have laid down precepts that are to be fully obeyed. I'm 100% on board. Oh, that my ways were steadfast in obeying your decrees. Then I would not be put to shame when I consider all your commands. Again, fully on board. Lord, might I do nothing wrong in front of you. I praise you with an upright heart as I learn your righteous laws. I will obey your decrees. Do not utterly forsake me. Again, as a listener, amen, amen. Then he keeps reading. I'm going to jump down to verse 18. Open my eyes that I may see the wonderful things in your law. Okay, good. Yeah, it's God's law. It'll be good. 20. My soul is consumed with longing for your laws at all times. In my brain right then, I kind of did a, well, if Jesus is the fulfillment of those, then my soul is consumed with longing for Jesus. I'm good. Keep going. Verse 24, your statutes are my delight. Huh. To me, law was that yoke, that burden, that Moses convinces us is not too heavy for us. It's still light, but I'm only believing that because I take his word for it. It doesn't feel like that. Verse 39, take away the disgrace I dread, for your laws are good. How I long for your precepts. Preserve my life in your righteousness. 43, do not snatch the word of truth from my mouth, for I have put my hope in your laws. Well, as I'm listening to this as a student, I'm almost at a theological disconnect because, wait a minute, are the laws good because they lead to salvation? Is that what I put my hope in them? What's going on theologically? And I'm struggling. Verse 48, I lift up my hands to your commands, which I love, and I meditate on your decrees. 42, I remember your ancient laws, O Lord, and I find comfort in them. Well, right here, about this point, I realize that we have two perspectives. One, we love the law. That's what the Old Testament author is saying. And then mine. The law is a burden, but I'm glad God gave it to us. That's about as far as I can get. And let me let you evaluate which one I'm going to put more weight on. In other words, who's right? The Old Testament author or me? obviously the Old Testament author, but I don't quite share the joy and the delight. In Psalm 19, I don't have time to go into all of it for you, but the author sets up for us examples of how we see the glory of God. And the first part of the Psalms, he points to the heavens and to creation and to everything. And he talks about that as the way we see the glory of God. In the second portion of the chapter, he parallels that with Torah, the instruction. The laws are like as beautiful as a sunset to him. Now, he doesn't use those words. He does, however, say they're like sweet honey. In my translation, it's loose translation, they're like fine European chocolate. They're wonderful. Now, again, I've already explained to you the disconnect. I would imagine some of you are relating to the same disconnect. I'm going to read for you a copy. And again, Dr. Block was the one that read this to me the first time. He has this in his commentary. He has this in a number of his articles. It is a prayer from the ancient Near Eastern world that expresses the heart of people at the time. It's written from a little later time period than the Mosaic time period. But it is still from the ancient Near Eastern world, and it's believed that the copies that we have are, and we have a couple, we have more than one version of this. This was a common prayer among Israel's neighbors, and it's believed that this is a prayer that has been prayed for a very long time and then is eventually written down. And it expresses the heart cry of the culture. Now, before I do that, I want to put it into context for you. If I were to talk about the heart cry of our culture, it would be things like, what is my purpose? Why am I here? These are the heart cries of our culture. So that you have a parallel from our culture. I always thought the heart cries of a culture were the same in every culture. But according to this prayer allows me to suspect that maybe they're not. There are different heart cries. So let me read this. I'm going to read it all the way through because I think it's important to hear the repetition and the length of it. It will lead to that feeling of, well, you'll feel it whether I tell you or not, anxiety, intense pursuit, those kinds of things. Again, a prayer from the ancient Near Eastern world, an Assyrian prayer that reflects the heart cry. So, may my Lord's angry heart be reconciled. By the way, this is called the prayer to any God. May the God I do not know be reconciled. Problem number one. He doesn't know the God. He's not sure which one. There's lots. Remember, in the ancient Near Eastern world, there's no such thing as atheism. Obviously, there were gods, but there were many. I'm going to assume you guys all understand that and accept it, but just know that it's verifiable. There were many, many gods. Also, gods are characterized as being easily angered and aggressive toward people. So if something goes wrong in your life, it's because a god is mad at you and is attacking you. Nothing in life is beyond the realm of God. There is no dichotomy between spiritual and practical. By the way, that's true all through the Old Testament. So, first problem, he doesn't know the God. May the goddess I do not know be reconciled. May the God, whoever he is, be reconciled. May the goddess, whoever she is, be reconciled. May my personal God's heart be reconciled. May my personal goddess's heart be reconciled. May my God and my goddess be reconciled with me. May the God who has turned away from me in anger be reconciled. May the goddess who has turned away from me in anger be reconciled. Now, second problem. I do not know what wrong I have done. So he's in a crisis situation, enough so that he's going to pray this very passionate and lengthy prayer. And he doesn't know who it's to, and he doesn't know what he's done. He just knows God's angry because something bad externally is happening. I do not know the wrong I have done. My God did not call my name with favor. My goddess did not call my name with favor. My God did not pronounce my name with favor. My goddess did not pronounce my name with favor. I could not eat for myself the bread I found. I could not drink for myself the water I found. Now, this doesn't literally mean that he can't eat and drink. You maybe are familiar with this concept from the Old Testament. One of the greatest curses in the ancient Near East is that something would be futile. that you would go plant crops and not get to benefit from them, that you would build a house and not get to live in it. So this is a way of saying, this is the curse. I can eat food, but I'm not satisfied. I cannot drink for myself the water I found. I have perpetuated unwittingly an abomination to my God. I have unwittingly violated a taboo of my goddess. O Lord, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. O my goddess, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. O God, whoever you are, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. O goddess, whoever you are, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. Not to make light of it, but doesn't it start to sound like Dr. Seuss after a while? I do not know what wrong I have done. I do not know what sin I have committed. I do not know what abomination I have perpetrated. I do not know what taboo I have violated. The Lord is angry at me in his heart. The Lord has made me face the fury of his heart. A goddess, it didn't say the Lord, by the way, it says a god. I think I inserted that. A goddess has become enraged at me and turned me into a sick man. A god, whoever he is, has harmed me. A goddess, whoever she is, has laid misery upon me. Now we have the next problem. He doesn't know what to do. No idea. To make it right, something's got to give. He's got to do something to appease the god. I keep on searching, but nobody will help me. When I wept, they would not draw near. When I would make a complaint, no one would see. I am miserable. Blindfolded, I cannot see. Turn towards me, merciful God, as I implore you. I do homage to you, my goddess. I keep groveling before you. O God, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. O goddess, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. O Lord, turn towards me, I implore you. O goddess, look upon me, I implore you. O God, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. O goddess, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. How long, O my God, until your furious heart is calmed? How long, O my goddess, until your estranged heart is reconciled? How long, O God, whosoever you are, until your angry heart is calmed? How long, O goddess, whosoever you are, until your estranged heart is reconciled? Men are slow-witted and know nothing. No matter how many names they go by, what do they know? They do not know at all if they are doing good and evil or evil. O my Lord, do not cast off your servant. He is mired. Help him. Turn the sin which I perpetrated into a virtue. Let the wind bear away the wrong I committed. Many are my crimes. Strip them off like a garment. O my God, though my wrongs be 7 times 7, absolve my wrongs. O my goddess, though my wrongs be 7 times 7, absolve my wrongs. O God, whosoever you are, though my wrongs be 7 times 7, absolve my wrongs. O goddess, whosoever you are, though my wrongs be 7 times 7, absolve my wrongs. Do you hear his desperation? It sounds like lengthy repetition, but it's desperation. Absolve my wrongs. Let me sound your praise as if you were my real mother. Let your heart be reconciled as if you were my real mother or my real father. If only we were in relationship. Let your heart be reconciled. So this prayer reflects the questions, the heart cry of a culture. And just to review, what God is it? Who is the God? Which one are we interacting with at any given time? What did he do wrong? And what can he do to make it right? And it is into that culture that we read in the verses of Deuteronomy 5, which, by the way, is the home of the Decalogue, the Torah. We read, I am Yahweh, your God. Who am I? I'm this one who brought you out of the land of Egypt. I care about you. I've already redeemed you. And then he goes on and gives a list. Don't have any other gods before me. Here's what you do. And then, well, it's not even then. It depends if you're looking at Exodus or Deuteronomy. But he's already told them what to do if they mess it up. There's already a way. There's already a path. You go and sacrifice. You cleanse yourself. I've already made a way for when you break these laws. In fact, in Deuteronomy, one of my favorite pieces, he tells them at the end of the book, you're not going to get it. These are my instructions. You're not going to get it. And you can say if or when, it's key in Hebrew, if you fail, or when you fail, and I have to punish you and send you into exile, rest assured, I will bring you back. Such a beautiful picture. And my petition to you is to understand that law is grace. It is answering the heart cry of the people in a way that says, I am in relationship to you. I need not be a mystery. If anyone has been in a situation of domestic abuse, depending on the types of abuse, and I grew up in that kind of situation, do you know how terrifying it is to not know the rules? It's terrifying. And God comes in and says, don't be scared anymore, my paraphrase. Here's what I expect. Torah is grace. That's why in Deuteronomy 4, oh man, I love this stuff, sorry. Deuteronomy 4, listen, this is how Moses talks about law. I know he says later, it's not a burden, and you're going, yeah, he's saying that because we all feel like it is, so there's context for that. But listen to what he says before he even gives it. He says, I'm going to start in verse 5, usually I start in verse 1, but for time, I have so much I want to tell you. See, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me. Now he told them in Exodus, he's going to repeat them again, starting in Deuteronomy 5. This is Deuteronomy 4. So that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will make you look like a fool that has incredible burdens on you, and no one else will want to be like you. Honestly, that's how we treat Old Testament Torah, but that's not what Moses says. I'm sure you know that. It says, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations. Moses sets law up as evangelistic. This is how I'm going to reach the world and show who I am. This is a beautiful thing. Who will hear, the nations, will hear about the decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. How many of you look at the laws and go, oh, these are so wise. I wish someone had just told me these. Moses is telling us, look, this is wisdom. This is the way I'm going to reach the world, and this is how I'm going to help you walk wisely. It's also relational. Now, we think of the Old Testament, New Testament dichotomy usually as New Testament is relationship, Old Testament is law and separate. But Moses, who's functioning and living and even giving the decrees in Deuteronomy, says, surely this nation is great and wise and understanding. What other nation, verse 7, is so great as to have their gods near them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? What other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I'm setting before you today? So if nothing else, I was convinced at that point that, okay, law is grace. I want to understand it better. That didn't instantly come with me understanding it better, but it did lead me at least to pursue it. If you can't tell already, what I'm trying to do today is shift the lens through which you look at law. The first thing that I hope I just did was to prescribe value to the law. I want to take it out of the realm that we usually put it in. How do I understand these things? You know the first question I get when I teach on Deuteronomy or Old Testament about law? You can guess. I'll say it for you. You can guess. Do we have to do these things? And it's not a, do we have to? But there's part of that behind it, as if it's a drudgery. But it's a, what's my relationship to the law? And the first part is one of value. That law was a gift to you and to the nations. Now, I'm not trying to equate you with Israel. I'm just telling you, the law has value and it is a gift. The second thing that I want to go into with you is that I believe that law is based in the character of God. Now, we tend to think of the law as a list of tasks. Remember, I oversimplify, I understand this. As a list of tasks that we need to keep in order to, I'm identifying myself with Israel, and I'm talking as if I were in the Old Testament times as an Israelite, okay? So I'm thinking of law from the Old Testament perspective as a list that needs to be kept in order to make the community acceptable enough that God's holiness is allowed to interact with it, right? That's the picture we have in the back of our minds of law. But if we say that out loud, and I know there are some who look at the Old Testament differently than they do the New Testament, and I'm not going to try and take them on here or anywhere. But if we say that out loud, do we realize that we have just described a situation in which man can redeem himself? All of us, I assume, would come from a tradition where we understand that man cannot redeem himself. It is through Christ only that man can be redeemed. And I would argue that's never changed, ever. So it can't be that we're to do the laws in order to become more acceptable to God. At least for my theology, that doesn't fit. It also is nowhere said in the Old Testament. He does say, do these or, but the or is, sorry, or else I'll kill you. Bluntly stated. Right? It's not, or else I can't be near you. So what then is the purpose of Torah? Well, if God gives the laws and God is righteous, what, and he's telling you how to behave, what must the laws also be? Righteous. In fact, the text of Deuteronomy defines them as righteousness. And I would argue that they are given by a righteous God, and therefore they reflect his character. He wouldn't give us a law. This is just logic, right? He wouldn't give us a law that opposes his character. So fundamentally, these laws are based in his character. Now, let me show you really quickly. This is, I don't know, the cool stuff that I totally get lost in. A comparison of Deuteronomy 5, that's where the Ten Commandments are given in Deuteronomy, and Exodus 20, that's where the Ten Commandments are given in Exodus. And then I'm going to jump with you to Deuteronomy 10. I tell you that, so don't let me, because I might forget, don't let me forget. In the two givings of the Ten Commandments, there are fundamental differences, especially with regards to one law. And that is the law of the Sabbath. So both laws, the one in Exodus and the one in Deuteronomy, command that you observe the Sabbath. And they use very similar language. But in Exodus, it tells you you're to do that because, and it gives you the reason. And in Deuteronomy, it tells you that you're to do that because, but it gives you a different reason. And scholars look at the reasons, which I'll read to you in just a minute, and they say, well, of course they're different. The focus of the entire book is different. And they explain the difference by the literary setting. So, in Exodus 8, I'm going to read a couple verses. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth. So the reason for, because in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and earth. Okay, because God did the same thing, so we're supposed to emulate it. All right. The sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So the first law in Exodus is based on the character of God and some act he did in history at the beginning. The second one in Deuteronomy 5:12, observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. Sound familiar? This is supposed to sound familiar. neither you nor your son or daughter nor your manservant or maidservant nor your ox or your donkey or any of your animals nor the alien within your gates, so that your manservant and maidservant may rest as you do. Now, there's a beautiful explanation for this kind of this part of the instruction, and it's, I think all parents would know this. It could be easy to say, I get to rest, you make dinner. And they have to go do it because you're the one in authority and you get to tell them. And this law is saying, if you're the one in authority, this isn't just a rest for you, it's a rest for everyone. Make sure you include everyone. All right? Now, the text is going to give us the because. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Now, oftentimes scholars will look at these two passages, and they will say there is an ethical bent, a humanitarian bent, to the one in Deuteronomy, because Deuteronomy is really worried about people and how you treat them. And you see a lot more just ethical response to people. And so what he's saying is, remember, you were slaves, so treat your slaves well. Let them rest. And I have always struggled with that. It didn't make any sense. I don't like when the scriptures say two different things. I understand that it increases the value of the word of God, but I don't like it. And I was studying in a totally separate environment through the creation account. And I can't go into it, but in the creation account, the primary focus of the creation account is on the Sabbath day, the day of rest. I was trying to understand, you know, why is it so important that we rest? And then for the next class, on a different topic, I turn to these verses. And I read the one in Exodus that says, because that's what God did. So do it because God did it. And then I come to this one, and it says, do it because you were slaves. I don't know how to walk you through my thought process, and that would take too long, but let me pause it, although I can't interact with scholarship here because no one has said this, but let me pause it that both reasons are grounded in the character of God. And that when he says in Exodus, because God rested when he made you, he's pointing back to the biggest revelation of God the people have had, creation. That's the peace. He made everything. He made it beautiful. He made it right. And he rested. When he gets to Deuteronomy, Moses is thinking of the same attribute of God, but now the people have a different picture. They're number one and closest to their heart, individual personal experience with God, they're the second generation of this, is when God brought them out of Egypt. I do not think the emphasis here or anywhere else, really, in Scripture on remember you were servants is on their servitude. It is on the God that redeemed them. And this is the place where Israel knows what it looks like when God brings rest, when he redeems. And I would argue from Genesis that what the purpose of the Sabbath is to remember every week, not just rest because it feels good and we need it desperately and we're an exhausted culture, but because God will complete things. He will bring rest. He will bring redemption. Every week, in short, we get to celebrate heaven. We get to celebrate the peace of the character of God by sitting still and relaxing and remembering that he holds the world in his hands and ultimately takes care of it. And that picture for Israel went in Deuteronomy that's closer and more intimate and will speak more loudly to them is the redemption from Egypt. Look, I redeemed you. Remember the Sabbath. Once a week, remember, I got you. The work is complete. You can rest. I redeemed you. And the picture of both is the same character of God as demonstrated in relationship to Israel by his actions toward them. So I would say, yeah, they're the same grounds. Both Exodus and Deuteronomy are the same grounds. Now, why does that matter besides exciting me? I don't know. Because what I would argue is that all of the law is given so that we might know the character of the God who gave it. He says, do these things to be like me. Now, you might think I'm making that up or paraphrasing. I am paraphrasing, but let me read to you where he says this in Deuteronomy 10. He says in verse 12, and now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today for your own good. Basically, obey me, but fleshed out in love and obedience and service and walking in my way, all of these things. And he's going to give them two reasons. One, because I'm God. That should be enough, but he gives them another. Here's the because I'm God, verse 14. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth, and everything in it. Yet the Lord set his affection on your forefathers and loved them, and he chose you, their descendants, above all the nations as it is today. Because I'm God, I made the world, and then I demonstrated my mercy by picking you. And by the way, since we can't get there, Genesis 12 tells us that he did indeed pick them, blessed them mightily, protected them, but he picked them in order to reach the world. Now he says, circumcise your hearts, therefore. I'm God, I loved you. Therefore, obey me. Change your attitude toward me. Does this sound at all New Testament? It should. This is how God works with his people. Circumcise your hearts, therefore, and do not be stiff-necked any longer. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords. In other words, God is God. I mean, I don't know how to make it any plainer. God didn't know how to make it any plainer. The problem is, and the reason I keep going on about this, is because I honestly don't get it. I can't picture him big enough. The Lord your God is God of gods, Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. Now we're sounding like the law. He's going to tell them to do the same thing in case you haven't read Deuteronomy in the last week. I'm just giving you a heads up. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the alien, giving him food and clothing. And you are to love those who are aliens, for you yourselves were aliens in Egypt. Okay, got it? You don't love them because you were them. You love them because you were them, and God loved them, you. Do you get it? You do this because God does it. He says, I love the fatherless and the widows, therefore you love the fatherless and the widows. We follow law. He gives us law so that we figure out, so that we learn who he is. Fear the Lord your God and serve him, hold fast to him and take your oaths in his name. He is your praise, he is your God, who performed for you those great and awesome wonders you saw with your own eyes. Your forefathers went down to Egypt, were 70 in all, and now the Lord has got, your God has made them as numerous as the stars in the sky. So Torah is grace, but it is also the character of God. Point number two. Now, it's the character of God, and it's taught in a way that is incredibly brilliant and pedagogical. By that I just mean it's taught by teaching. But it sounds more scholarly if you say pedagogical. But Moses has, the culture has, God has, I don't know, an incredible strategy when he teaches. He's going to tell Israel sometimes who he is. He says, I am the God of compassion and loving kindness. But I have to be honest, we're not the brightest batch. We hear those things, but we, even in the very best attempts, we can't picture them fully. What does it mean that he's compassionate? What does it mean that he's gracious? What does it mean that he has loving kindness, that it never fails? We don't get to see that very often in the world. And when we do, it's a snippet. So he tells us, but the words only convey so far. I'll give an example. I think I mentioned this one yesterday talking with Mark. What he decides to do instead is say, I am this way, So you go walk this way, so that you can figure out while you're doing it what it is that I am. So the example I gave is this summer my son wanted to whittle. We were camping. He found a knife in the camping box and wanted to carve a tree, which makes mommy thrilled. It's a sharp knife. I'm concerned for him, so I need to give him instruction ahead of time. Now, I did not sit on my hands and say, "Now, son, hold the end of the blade that, or the end of the knife that doesn't have the blade. Hold the stick in your other hand. Leave it slightly off your lap. You're going to brush with the blade away from you." Look, I can't even sit on my hands and do it. And orally run through this process. I wouldn't trust that. He's 8 years old. He'll get hurt. Nor did I say, "Hey, do this, let me show you," which would be another great way to teach. But this is a knife in my son's hands, so I'm not going to trust the second best way. The best way to teach him is to go over next to him, put my hand around his hand with the knife. He's left-handed, so it went the other way. Put my hand around the other hand with the branch, lean the branch off his knee in his hand, and start brushing away. Do this. Don't, and then you show him what not to do. But you don't even use his hand to show him, not because he might get hurt, but you don't want to reinforce or plant any behavior that might be harmful to him in him. Parents, we know this, right? This is how you teach effectively. I'm telling you, God does the same thing. He says, love the widow and orphan. Why? Because as you're loving that one that has nothing to give back to you and is entirely vulnerable, at some point, not only are other people watching and going, "Huh, that's unique." These are people, by the way, that we would be told when they gave something to someone, they would charge tons and tons of interest. Remember, this is how the Israelites are described. Don't stop doing that to your... So those people that would be looking to gain are going to watch someone who has nothing to gain by helping someone who can't help themselves. So it looks beautiful on the outside, and we hear this all the time in the church. Someone can ask, "Why are you doing this?" "Oh, let me tell you about God." That's the reflection of him, but I believe there's a deeper purpose. And Scripture tells us over and over and over what it is. So that while you're behaving like him, one day it occurs to you, "Oh, this is what God did for me. I have nothing to give back. I understand compassion now. I understand mercy now, not because it was explained to me or shown me, but because I experientially learned it." It's the deepest way we can learn things. I would submit that that is what Torah is. Now, do I understand all the laws? Nope. I don't. But I believe that at the root of them, that's what each one of them are. The second thing that we have to understand about Torah is that it's given in a story culture. A story would be kind of like an Old Testament selfie. We take a picture of what something looks like. It's not a description. Well, it is. But it's not a, what do you call it? You're the language person. What do you call it? It's not a third-person description of what's going on so that we can understand a deeper print. Well, it is. That's story. I just defined story. I'm finding trouble finding the words. But it is a snapshot. It is a reflection. Normally what I do when I'm teaching is I introduce myself first, and I introduce my family. And when I introduce my family, I don't show a picture of them. And even if they're in the audience with me, I don't call them up front. I tell one story about each person that the audience then feels like, "Hey, I know them." That's what kind of culture Torah is given. So I'll give you an example. My 10-year-old, my third-born daughter, Emily, she's probably the most like me. That makes it both a joy and a challenge to raise her. And when I say most like me, what does that mean? Unless you know me well, it doesn't mean much. So I'll tell you a story about her. When she was 3 years old, if it takes you a second to get it, that's kind of the point of the story. So she had a babysitter for the first time since we had moved to Oregon. And the babysitter was, you know, taking care of the household. It was just her and her little brother, who was one. And the babysitter was otherwise occupied. And Emily walked toward the sliding glass door that led to the backyard and started to open it. And the babysitter looked up and said, "Hey, Emily, are you allowed to go outside by yourself?" And without missing a beat, Emily looked at her and said, "Not if I ask." Yeah. Yeah, it took you a second. Didn't hurt take her any time at all. That's the kid I'm raising. Do you see her now? Do you see her? That's a story culture. That's the power of a story. And law is given in to a story culture. So when he asks us to partake in his character traits, he describes them frequently. Now, he also says, "Thou shalt not." But he frequently places them in a story context. Now, scholars debate, are these actual cases? A divorce text that I read to you earlier is a perfect example of that. It describes a picture, a soap opera-like picture. Scholars, again, debate whether or not that's an actual story that happened and then it's recorded for us, or if it's a made-up story to illustrate a point, or does it happen first and then the law is made after it if the law isn't recorded? You know, there's all kinds of scholarly discussion around that, but ultimately, I don't think it matters for my sake when I come to understand the text. I want to understand what each one of these things are. By the way, there is a New Testament story picture, and when I say story, I am not talking about something that is not historical, of Torah, and it is Jesus. He is what Torah looks like when it's lived without imperfection. Every once in a while when I'm teaching, I get so passionate about Torah that my students will ask me, I've had this twice, two separate years, two totally different classrooms, "You love Torah so much, do you still love Jesus?" And I would tell them, and I do, I answer them, if you properly value Torah, the picture of how you look at Jesus will change. It will go from, and I'm oversimplifying again, but I believe it will hit home, law is bad / imperfect, and Jesus is good. If you're going to compare something, let me give an example. I hate liver and onions. I like lobster better than liver and onions. Do you have any idea how much I like lobster? No, because I compared it to something I hate. If you understand that Torah is a reflection of God, the character of God, that is given into a culture that is broken and walked out by people who are broken, the imperfections that we perceive in Torah are because of us, not because of the character of God. They're our imperfections. And Torah is lifted up in the scriptures as the most beautiful portrayal of the picture of God. Again, Psalm 19, but many, many places. The difference between Torah and Jesus is that when Jesus walks it, he is the person of God walking out the character of God. There's no flaw. So Torah is amazing, and Jesus is better. You catch it? Okay. Let me check the time really quickly. I have no idea when I started. Hopefully by now you have caught value of Torah. Challenge everything I say, by the way. This is what I meant to say at the beginning when I was talking about speaking as someone in a position of authority. It can be tempting, not because of any ability on my part, but because someone put me up here and someone before that stamped a degree behind my name. It can be tempting to just accept anything that's said. Please don't. Please, please, please don't test all of this. So if you're experiencing a paradigm shift, which I hope you are, I hope I'm giving you new lenses, don't just put them on. Read and test for yourself. That's one of the things I love about academia. I can trust my listeners to do that, and I'm trusting you to do that. All right, let me tell you a couple other things with that perspective shift. There's a few other things we need to understand to read Torah. And at the end of this, I will give you a case study. I will walk you through the case study, and I will show you how all of these pieces, at least that's my intention, all of these pieces lead into a different interpretation of a passage than your initial gut reading. Okay? So I've already said the Old Testament law is instruction. By the way, Torah just means instruction, and that this is a teaching tool that God is very gently teaching us what he looks like, with an awareness that we may or may not get it right away. I've mentioned that imitation of it is the means to a relationship. He does this. I think I started to go here and then went on a rabbit trail. He tells us these things because he wants us to know him. It's not because he wants us to be cleaner. I'm sure he does. But I think he wants us to be cleaner. I'm not using the Old Testament kind of clean and unclean. I mean the more holy, more pure, have lives that more reflect his, because it's for our best interest. And it also reaches the world. So it's kind of win-win. But the real reason he wants it is because he wants to know us. Now, that is a question I can't answer. I have a whole teaching on Exodus. I won't go into it all, but I will tell you that the best class I ever taught was a class I drove 3 hours up to teach, a long weekend class. And when I walked into the room, by the way, my son had fallen on the playground. We put him in the car to take him up there. We had checked him out. Everything seemed fine. By the time we got there, we realized that the way he was sitting in the car seat was odd, and he had a broken collarbone. But I have 10 minutes to get in to teach, so my husband has to take him to the emergency room. Talk about mother sacrifice. I'm like, Lord, I am laying this at the altar. This is all for you. Meanwhile, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, am I supposed to do this? Does this make me a bad mom? So there's the setting. Context is important. I walk into the room. There are 2 students. I did all this for 2 students. I walk in the room and they see she's a young girl. I was expecting a real teacher. So we had immediately a little bit of a, they were not rude. I was not rude. It was the best class I have ever been in. I learned so much. But at the beginning of the class, I was pushing the students to be really honest. We just sat at a table and talked. And you can imagine from the way I'm teaching now, we were all over the place. But I said, look, I want you to be honest about the way you view God in the Old Testament. Really, really honest. And they weren't. They were being as honest as they felt free to be, but they were being seminarians who are protecting what they know and what they're supposed to say, like we all do, because if we're too vulnerable, we look like we don't love God and we let him down and we don't defend him enough. And finally, one of the men who had a beard to hear and shoulders to hear, he's since become a very dear friend, slammed his hand on the table and said, I know what you want me to say. You want me to say that I get it, that I have a presupposition that God in the Old Testament is mean and God in the New Testament is good, but really they're the same now, today, yesterday, today, forever. He said, but I'll be honest. You wanted honesty. I mean, he's mad at this point. And I'm like, don't cower. It makes you look weak. Just stand your ground. And he said, I want to serve the God of the New Testament, the one after the veil was ripped. You know what veil he's talking about in the temple? That not the one where Gentiles aren't even allowed in the courts. I want a personal God. I was perfectly content at that point because we had real honesty and we were going to move forward. The next day, that night I taught on Genesis. The next day I taught on Exodus, which, by the way, is the story of a God who redeems his people, sets up a law, tells them to build a temple ad nauseum. I don't know, what is it, 8 chapters? Then the people disobey, crisis right in the middle of it, but sorry, at least there's some action. So we aren't glad that they disobeyed, but at least there's something to read in the text. This is the part where they say, you know, we made put gold in the fire and a cow jumped right out at us and they look like idiots and God's going to destroy them, and then he doesn't, and half the people are mad when they read this because God doesn't destroy them, and the other half are mad because God's supposed to destroy them if you understand Old Testament covenant, and on and on and on. And then they come down the mountain and everything's restored and God's going to move forward with them. And you have 6 more chapters of how they built the tabernacle. It's not the most exciting. Sorry if anyone's really into tabernacle and building. But for the reader, it's not the most exciting conclusion to this book. Until you realize that the reason it's so intricate is because it's so important. And the reason it's so important is because it is not just a temple. I know it's a temple, but when we use that word, we start getting all religious. It is going to house God. And if you read the very end of the book, how many of you know when you read a novel where the most important part of the book is? It's the end. It's the conclusion. It's the resolution. If you read the end of the book, after it says everything was built just the way it was supposed to be and blah, blah, and you sacrifice and you have this and you have the tithe, and I really don't mean to make light of it, but it's very, very long. It says that the Spirit of God, that the glory of God descended in a cloud and lived in the temple. And that student who the day before had slammed the table, and I'm talking big, burly, outdoors huntsman, bearded, Portland student. I looked up and he was weeping. And I just sat there. I don't know what to do in a class of two people when someone starts crying. And he said, "You mean to tell me that the God of Israel loved the people so much that he was willing to come down out of heaven and live in a box just to be near them?" Yeah, that's the reason for Torah, not to clean you up so that he can be in your presence, but so that you can know him. He doesn't want a relationship with us that's like, you know that song, that pop song about 5 years ago? Something about what's your name? I love him, but I don't know his name. No! He wants that deep relationship that comes from walking with and knowing him. All right. Another point. I have it listed on my paper as point two, but I promise that wasn't all point one. Biblical laws are set for people in positions of authority rather than by those in authority. In other words, when the laws are given, they are given to the heads of household. I had a long conversation with Dr. Block this year in which he finally concurred that the heads of household are both male and female. Do you remember the lists I read to you in Exodus and Deuteronomy? You, your sons and daughters, your manservants, your maidservants, your cattle, your donkey, this foreigner in your gates. You is anyone who holds authority. That's the wife isn't not listed because she's less important than a donkey and she didn't make the grade. The wife isn't listed because she's walking side by side. So this is to the people in authority, not for them, but that's the opposite of what I just said. These laws are addressing them. Dr. Block calls this, rightly so, the Bill of Other People's Rights. Deuteronomy is about what do you do if you have authority in the situation? How do you behave? And a lot of the laws, not all of them, but a lot of the laws are on authority, and those tend to be the ones that I focus on. I already told you that laws are given as illustrations. They're set within a story culture, very different than modern law. Ancient Near Eastern law can seem sporadic. In other words, we have something about a roof and something about a cow and its mother's milk and something about a divorced person and something about a son who's rebellious. And it's just like, and over here, it's where you're supposed to go to the bathroom. And over here, it's what kind of clothes you're supposed to put on. And it just seems very sporadic. Ancient Near Eastern law is often like that. And I believe that those, it's hard to use words here, scholars get up in arms about using the correct word. So this may not be the correct word, but it's about the principles, that's the iffy, difficult word because of scholarship, and I would agree that it's iffy and difficult. The principles or behind the laws or the paradigms that the laws are supposed to address. I have all these examples on here. The one I'm going to give right now is the one about Paul and the oxen. So in 1 Corinthians 9:9 and 1 Timothy 5:18, both times Paul cites the law from Deuteronomy 25 verse 4 that says even the oxen gets to feed from the grain when he's threshing. And Paul doesn't expound that law by saying, now, see how we should treat animals? Instead, he says, this is, well, he uses the law as evidence for why pastors should get compensation for what they do. And we look at that and think, what in the world? That's a law about an animal. And it's about an animal eating food. It's not about a pastor or compensation or payment. We look at the laws incorrectly. That's my blanket statement. I have just stated that I think that the laws look sporadic. They look like they're all over the place, but they are indeed very exhaustive. There is nothing I can find that's not addressed in the law. The particulars of everything might not be addressed, but you name a topic, and I can tell you a law that addresses that topic. Perhaps not the surface of the law, oxen, but compensation, there it is. Money, it's in there. Sex, it's in there. Clothing, it's in there. The way you make your clothing, I don't understand why. I don't understand what that law means. You're not supposed to weave different kinds of fabrics. I have some ideas, but that's in there. Everything about Israel's life becomes a picture and an opportunity for them to learn about the character of God. Food. I really don't understand all the food laws. All of the food laws, I believe, are in there to explain something about them. Let me give you one more example, and then I'm going to move on to the case study, the one we're going to do, and we'll go through that quickly. I am positing this, test this, test this, test this, test this, test this. But one of the things I love the most about Old Testament law is when it's tricky, when it's tough. It's just in my nature to enjoy that. And some of the laws I focus on frequently in later work, I haven't even written on them yet, are a lot of the laws in Leviticus, things that make you clean and unclean, times that God tells people that if something's wrong with them, that could have been wrong from birth, they can't serve him in the way they would have expected to be able to serve him. What does that tell us about God? He can look abusive. And I can't go into all of this here, but I'm going to pause it. I'm going to throw out there something for you to test. In Leviticus, let me back up. When I talk to you about Exodus, I talk to you about the value that you have to God. Not just as someone created in his image. I can get that. If we reflect him, of course we're valuable to him. He made us. That's cool. I'm good with that. His love, I can do that. That's okay. We don't deserve it, but he's a loving God. He loves us based on his character. I can take that. Him craving relationship with us such that he wants physical proximity in the Old Testament and the New Testament. There's the manger. And then there's the Holy Spirit dwelling in us. That kind of desire, not just love acting on your behalf, but like, desire for us, I can't explain. But it's countered in the same way that a good story culture would need to do, because if you only give one side of the picture, you can't, you risk arrogance. Oh, I'm so good. In fact, that's one of the problems of man. Is the arrogance from the beginning of Genesis when they want to be like God. They want to be divine. They forget the difference between themselves and God, that they are not divine. Ecclesiastes tells us, it's one of my favorite verses right now, God is in heaven, man is on earth. I wish it stopped there and said, booyah! God is in heaven, man is on earth. That's your place. But in Leviticus, I think that the clean and unclean laws, they're separated from morality. So there's sin offerings, all that kind of stuff in the book. But then there's also clean and unclean. Now, certain acts can make you unclean that are sinful, but primarily, well, actually, I'm not even sure that's true. That's not true. We conceive of that. I don't think that's true at all. But what makes you unclean? I'm going to give you the list. These are things that when you hear them, be aware that you're going to feel a sense of repugnance. Probably because we have been told they're unclean. So blood, death, menstruation, actually any bodily emission, vomit. What else makes you unclean? Touching a dead body. I said that. Everything. Oh, I said death. What else is there? I have an exhaustive list in my head and back in the office, and it's not coming to the forefront of my mind. And we feel a little bit of, ugh, when we hear those things, right? Yes, no, with me, not with me, sleeping, awake, yeah. But think about it. What does the text say about blood? What does God say about blood? He says that the life is in it. It's nothing repugnant to God. That's where life is. In fact, when blood is spilled out on the ground, he doesn't run the other way. In fact, blood cries out to him. It's like he has a relationship with the blood. Now, that's anthropomorphic language. I understand what the text is doing there, but blood is a beautiful thing. The life is in the blood. Menstruation. It's not just because it's blood. It also represents the fertility. The highest goal of an Israelite's life was for progeny. Someone who couldn't menstruate, wouldn't menstruate, didn't menstruate, would have mourned that they had no cycle. It may seem icky, but it's highly valued and not something moral. Death, staying away from death. If any of you, and back up, in scriptures, one of the greatest restrictions put on someone in time of, usually it looks like punishment, is that when someone dies, you're not to go near them. And I'm talking specifically, when your son dies, talking to Aaron, you can't mourn them or go near them, you can't touch them, you can't bury them. That is put on as a difficulty. Why? Because caring for the body of a lost one, of a dead one, is the most precious thing. If you've ever lost someone, we had a son who died 2 hours after birth, to have been told you may not touch his body would have been unimaginable. Unimaginable. In fact, for weeks I drove by the funeral home because that's where he was. Now I understand that we have this, oh, it's death thing. But to come into contact with one you love who has died is an honor. I was at the funeral for my mother-in-law in open casket earlier this year. All I wanted to do was kiss her forehead. Can I just kiss her goodbye one more time? It was cold and felt weird and I didn't, but I had to. Not because I was socially obligated, but because my heart cried for that. If you think about it, the pieces that God declares are unclean, well, let's look at it. Who would be the most unclean person in society? Probably the mother. She's going to clean up after the vomit when her kids are sick. She's going to help the neighbor who can't help themselves. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to school and I'm about to go out the door and some toddler pees on me. I got to change my clothes. If it was the Old Testament, I'd have to drive by the altar, slaughter something, take a shower, and go to work. I think, this is my hypothesis, that the pieces that God declares unclean are the most precious parts of our humanity. And when he declares them unclean, he is teaching the people something. He is teaching them that your very best is not divinity. I'm God, you're man. The best that man has to offer. The pieces I made you of you that are the greatest, the blood that flows through your veins is human blood. And the people need to see a picture of that. What does it look to be human before God? Well, it's not divinity. Understand that. It's not holy. It's not sanctified. It's not God. And I think all of Leviticus, most of Leviticus, is a picture of what it means to be human so that we don't take just the story of Exodus where we're loved, but we also take the story of Leviticus and recognize that we're loved, but we're not divine. All right, so how do you take all of these lenses and look freshly at a text? I'm going to have you turn to Numbers, or I'll just read it to you. Numbers 5:11. Now, I picked this text intentionally because it's difficult, and because when most people read it, they look at it through old lenses, and I'll be honest, if we had more time and more space, I would ask your response to it. And I think it would be unfavorable, as mine used to be. The Lord says to Moses, this is labeled in my Bible as a test for an unfaithful wife. Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him by sleeping with another man, and this is hidden from her husband, and her impurity is undetected since there's no witness against her, and she's not been caught in the act, and if feelings of jealousy come over her husband and he suspects his wife and she is impure, or if he's jealous and suspects her even though she is not impure, then he is to take his wife to the priest. He must also take an offering of a tenth of an ephah of barley flour on her behalf. He must not pour oil on it or put incense in it, because it is a grain offering for jealousy, a reminder offering to draw attention to guilt. The priest shall bring her and have her stand before the Lord. Then he shall take some holy water in a clay jar and put some dust from the tabernacle floor into the water. After the priest has had the woman stand before the Lord, he shall loosen her hair and place her in her hands the remainder offering, the grain offering for jealousy, while he himself holds the bitter water that brings a curse. Then the priest shall put the woman under oath and say to her, if no other man has slept with you and you have not gone astray and become impure while married to your husband, may this bitter water that brings a curse not harm you. But if you have gone astray while married to your husband and have defiled yourself by sleeping with a man other than your husband, here the priest is to put the woman under this curse of oath. May the Lord cause your people to curse and denounce you when he causes your thigh to waste away and your abdomen to swell. May this water that brings a curse enter your body so that your abdomen swells and your thigh wastes away. Then the woman is to say, amen, so be it. Can you imagine? The priest is to write these curses on a scroll and then wash them off into the bitter water. He'll have the woman drink the bitter water that brings a curse, this water that has dirt in it. And this water will enter her and cause bitter suffering. The priest is to take from her hands the grain offering for jealousy, wave it before the Lord, and bring it to the altar. The priest is then to take a handful of grain offering as a memorial offering and burn it on the altar. After that, he is to have the woman drink the water. If she has defiled herself and been unfaithful to her husband, then when she is made to drink the water that brings a curse, it will go into her and cause her bitter suffering, her abdomen to swell, and her thigh waste away, and she will become accursed among her people. If, however, the woman has not defiled herself and is free from impurity, she will be cleared of guilt and will be able to have children. This, then, is the law of jealousy. When a woman goes astray and defiles herself while married to her husband, or when feelings of jealousy come over a man because he suspects his wife, the priest is to have her stand before the Lord and is to apply this entire law to her. The husband will be innocent of any wrongdoing, but the woman will bear the consequences of her sin. All right, just by way of thumbs up or thumbs down, give me your emotional response. Go ahead, be brave. I got three people. Yeah, there we go. Thumbs up. Yeah. How interesting. I happen to know the audience just a little bit. And I know the ones that are giving the thumbs up and why. And the rest are giving thumbs down. It feels offensive when we come to this text. Now, let me first say I haven't done the kind of work in this text that I've done in the divorce text and in other texts. So we're not going to go into it in that way. But it feels offensive. This woman, who is suspected of doing something horrible, not just horrible, but the worst thing you can do, have an affair. No one knows. I mean, God is obviously going to know, but no one knows if it's true or not. No one can find any proof. There's no other man to be found. Why aren't they tracking him down and dragging him in and making him drink water? Right? I'm a woman. I can say this. Ugh! And she's got to stand there while the priest pronounces a curse on her, and she has to say, oh, amen, that's what I want. And then she's got to drink the dirt with scrapes of ink and paper and temple dust in it. And then she waits. Now, let me cut right to it. And some of you already know this. I can see it in your eyes when you give me the thumbs up. Here is a woman who has no defense. How do you prove a negative? What is she supposed to do when her husband says, I think you've been cheating on me? Say, I didn't? Okay, good. I have personally been in situations where when I professed not only innocence but purity before the Lord to accusers, I was told, well, of course you would say that. That's what any guilty person would say. There is nothing she can do. Now, the husband's also stuck because can he just offer her grace and not worry about it? Not if he honors the Torah and if he understands how grievous this offense is. He's got to do something. If she's been immoral, this matters to the community, and other laws tells us this brings abomination to the land, and God's going to protect the land. So we are in a no-win situation, and the most vulnerable person here is the woman. And into that situation, God comes and says, not put cyanide in the water, have her drink the water, and I will protect her if she is innocent. No. He says, put dust and ink in the water and have her drink the water. And if she is guilty, I'll take care of it. But if she is not, leave her alone. God cares so much about the vulnerable, even when there is a chance that she is guilty of grave sin, that he steps in to be her voice when she has no voice, and to be her protection when she has no protection. Now let's go back to the beginning. Do we have to do these things? Who cares? Who cares? Do we have to follow biblical law? Does biblical law apply to... I don't care. I don't care at all, because the question should instead be, how? How do I take law that reflects the character of God and act it out in my life? If we are supposed to be like God, like Christ, then we will do what his voice here did for the woman. We will be the protection. Now, how do you go about doing that? Good thing I'm a scholar and not a pastor. I don't know. I can't put dust in a glass of water and I... But I think the point is, whether this had to do with adultery, whether this had to do with a woman, could have been a foreigner who's accused of stealing, I think. But I think the author intentionally picks a severe crime and a vulnerable person who has no voice. If we want to reflect the character of God, we are called to be the defender. So should a woman be safe in the church? Yes, because anyone in authority, male or female, should balance the upholding of the law of God. By that I mean, I'm making it too spiritual, the upholding of God's commandments, the things that we are and are not supposed to do. We have to balance that with the compassion, the extra compassion that is needed, and the defense that is needed for someone who is voiceless and vulnerable. And even though it's America and we are modern, in our churches today, that is often still the women. I should have a great closing, but I hope that you see clearly how precious God is as defender of the voiceless, and that even passages we think might be entirely irrelevant for our culture. In fact, I think 100% of the people that I would ask the question, do you want this still to go on today? Even if they think it's a good thing, would be like, no, please don't take me in before my pastor and tell him to drink me. But there are some who have been oppressed who would probably plead for something like this. And I would argue they shouldn't have to. There should be someone in authority standing next to them, being their voice for them. That's what biblical Torah looks like. That's it. Thank you.